First Amendment freedoms, and government transparency. This is the foundation to a healthy democracy. Welcome to the NEFAC Report, where we discuss your rights to free speech, freedom of the press, and an open, accountable government. I'm Alexandra Tavallone, production manager for the NEFAC Report, and part of a student team at Roger Williams University working with New England First Amendment Coalition. Thanks for joining us. In this episode, we'll be hearing about unconstitutional speech ordinances at town meetings in New Hampshire. NEFAC President and Media Law Attorney Gregory V. Sullivan joins Coalition Executive Director Justin Silverman to explain why these restrictions are so concerning and how NEFAC is responding. Later in the show, we'll hear from NEFAC Board Member and Vermont ACLU Senior Staff Attorney Harrison Stark. Harry will explain to us why certain court documents aren't available online in Vermont and how the Coalition is fighting for more access. But first, here's Justin and Greg.
Greg, thanks for joining. Let's jump right into it. Public meetings by government bodies and commentary that individuals like you and myself can give at these meetings. NEFAC got involved in an issue in Nashua where there was an unconstitutional ordinance, a restriction on our speech that violated the First Amendment. We got involved, changes were made, and now we're looking to do the same thing in Manchester. So I'm going to have you discuss what those ordinances are, how they run afoul of the First Amendment. But I need you to first provide a little context for those that may be asking themselves, okay, well, what is an open meeting? What is this public comment period all about? Let's start there.
Well, you got to start with the premise, as they always do, that we the people are the government, and government officials are acting as our servants and agents. So when they meet to make policy, discuss policy, generally speaking, the public has a right to listen, not always participate, but most frequently public bodies will have a public comment session, which will be anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes per speaker. And of course, the presiding officer, whether it's a board of aldermen or a city council, the presiding officer has the right to keep things orderly, peaceful, and to limit sometimes the time that a speaker speaks and other times the topic. Sometimes we can talk about anything a citizen would like, and other times we're limited to items that are on the agenda for that day or evening.
So let me pause you right there, Greg, because we all know we have free speech under the First Amendment. If I want to go out to a town common and protest, if I want to hold a large banner for whatever cause I might be promoting, I can do that. So what gives these public bodies the right to limit my speech when they're opening up a public comment period?
Well, even on the town common, your free speech is not absolute. The government has always had the ability to impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. What the bodies have been trying to do, however, is limit the nature or the viewpoint of the speech of the speakers, and that is a violation of the First Amendment. These cases actually started in Massachusetts, where I believe it was the town of Southborough, had an ordinance similar to the ones in Nashua and Manchester, New Hampshire, and many other cities and towns in New Hampshire, I might add, saying that you cannot use coarse, rude, vulgar language, among other categories. And of course, you know, some of the arguments in favor of those ordinances are these meetings are often televised and there are children that need to be protected from speech that's, I'll say, inappropriate.
Let me ask you then, Greg. I mean, isn't that a reasonable restriction, making sure that the youth of our nation aren't exposed to such vulgar and offensive words?
Well, you know, it comes down to the parents or the guardians have a job to do, and the citizens of the community have a job to do. And we have the right, courts have now held, to speak in crude, offensive, rude, vulgar manners. In fact, in 1989, the Supreme Court of the United States said if there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it's that the government may not shut us up just because society as a whole or part of society is offended by what we're saying. We have the right to be offensive.
Let me ask you then, Greg, because we have this right. What would be the harm in having government, or in this case, these public bodies, determine for us what is rude, crude, and offensive?
Our whole society, our whole democracy is premised on the fact that we need wide open debate on topics of public concern. The majority can't always prevail when it comes to minorities' rights, because what concepts we may hate today may become very popular concepts tomorrow. And that's what the marketplace of ideas is all about. And again, that's what our democracy is based upon, is the citizens' ability to have wide open, robust debate on topics of public concern.
I think it's worth noting that the Supreme Judicial Court in Massachusetts, the state's highest court, really emphasized what you just did and said, in order for us under the First Amendment to have this robust political debate, we need the freedom to express ourselves emotionally, provocatively. And in order to do that, as the court said, we've seen throughout hundreds of years of history of political debate in this country, we need the right to be emotional, provocative, and that type of emotion often comes out in profanity, vulgarity, impolite expression, which is now being restricted, or at least we have public bodies trying to restrict that expression in New Hampshire. So let's go north from Massachusetts to New Hampshire, cross the state line here. Let's start with Nashua. What was the ordinance and why was it problematic?
The original ordinance in Nashua outlawed crude, vulgar, profane, and or obscene remarks. We got them to delete crude and vulgar from their ordinance. It still now prohibits profane and or obscene remarks. I have no idea what profanity is in today's society, and I don't know what an obscene remark is. And that's pretty technical, because the Supreme Court of the United States has defined obscenity in the case of Miller versus California. And it's a lot easier for me to envision what is obscenity if we're talking about pictures and films. But obscene speech, I have grave difficulty conjuring up what exactly that would mean. I imagine it's speech that would offend. And as I've said, since 1989 in this country, we've certainly had the right to be offensive. Texas v. Johnson.
What we're talking about are speech restrictions that would allow a government body to provide an open forum for us to go speak our minds. But soon as we say something that's offensive or something that we think is entirely appropriate and needed for us to adequately express ourselves, government body can point their finger at us and say, no, you're being crude, you're being offensive. Either shut up and sit down, or we're going to have a police officer come along and escort you out. Those are the repercussions of these types of ordinances. And that's why we got involved in Nashua. That's why we made sure that they changed the ordinance there to make it easier for people to express themselves in the terms that they choose to express themselves without fear of being silenced or escorted out of a public meeting. So now fast forward a year, and let's go to Manchester. What type of ordinance is Manchester using, and why is that problematic?
The wording of the current Manchester rule, which is what they call it, speakers shall be civil in their language and presentation. Profanity, threats, and the use of vulgar language or fighting words are prohibited, in addition to any and all speech or actions which violate any applicable law. And it goes on to say that the chairperson of the meeting shall have the right to remove people who are engaging in disorderly conduct or interfering with the sessions or violating any other applicable law. So we've made suggestions to Manchester that you and I, Justin, worked on a recommended amendment where it would say speakers are encouraged to be civil in their language and presentation. True threats and the use of fighting words are prohibited. And that's it, because we have the right to be crude, rude, and vulgar, and I dare say even profane.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate you explaining these issues for us. They're very relevant to all of us throughout New England, because many towns and municipalities throughout the region Even in Massachusetts, where we had this very strong ruling from the SJC, still there are these types of ordinances that are on the books that are being imposed on all of us and restricting our right to, as you said, be rude, crude, and offensive, but more specifically and more importantly, restricting our right to express ourselves in the way that we alone see fit without having someone in government tell us otherwise.
That's what democracy is all about.
I'm Ed Fitzpatrick, a reporter at the Boston Globe, a NEFAC board member, and the host of the Rhode Island Report podcast. Our Globe Rhode Island team is based in Providence, providing daily digital coverage of all things Rhode Island. We also have a daily Roadmap newsletter and a weekly Rhode Island Food Club newsletter. We conduct investigations, holding the people in power accountable. We tell the stories that make Rhode Island so unique. And we remain committed to helping student journalists play a vital role in our democracy. To learn more, go to globe.com/Rhode Island.
Hey, this is Alexandra again. If you want to learn more about the topics being discussed in this episode, please take a look at our show notes. A link is provided wherever you're listening to this podcast. These notes include NEFAC resources, relevant court cases, news reports, and other interesting stuff. Check it out. Now, let's hear from Harrison Stark at the ACLU of Vermont. Here he is with Justin to discuss online access to court records.
Harry, thanks for joining us. I want to talk today about court records, particularly our access to records online. But before we jump online and discuss access there, can you first tell us generally what types of records are we entitled to if we go into a courthouse, not online, but if we go into a courthouse, ask for records, what's there waiting for us?
So Vermont has a presumptive right of access to many, but not all, records. And so the first question that kind of anyone needs to ask is, as a general rule, are the kinds of records I want to access, are they presumptively publicly accessible, or is there any sort of exemption or exception to that general rule? But in general, if you walk into a courthouse, you have a right of access to civil proceedings, to criminal proceedings, to contested probate matters, to any matters that are in the environmental division, so that's zoning, housing court, or the judicial bureau. You do not have access to family court and to a number of kind of specific items. And just as a general matter, Vermont's access to court records is a little bit of a funny hybrid. It is governed by statute, which provides by law what proceedings and what materials Vermonters have a right of access to. There is also a delegation of power to the judiciary to set their own rules about public access to court records. So the framework of public access to court records is governed by a mixture of legislative-made statute law and also a set of court-made rules. And those two overlay together to provide a little bit of a complex patchwork of rules and regulations about what you can have access to and what you can't.
And there's also a First Amendment right of access as well,
right? Of course. Yes, so there's a First Amendment right of access to court records. There is a common law right of access to court records and public proceedings. There are also independent Vermont state constitutional provisions, which provide a right of access to know what the government is doing and to hold the government accountable, which of course the court has read into that right, a right of access to know what the government is actually doing.
Why do we have all of these rights? Why is it so important that we have access to the courts and all of these records that you just described?
The idea that all power in government is derived from the public and from the people, that's always true. And that's true for any institution. And in order to confirm and to know how that power is being exercised, we need to know what the government is doing. And public records are an excellent tool for doing that. It's essential that we're able to access both court proceedings themselves, that is sort of any member of the public can go into a courthouse, can see how the power is being interpreted, and also to see how that is reflected in court record. Not everything that courts do happens during a publicly scheduled hearing. Most contested matters are resolved through some sort of decision the judge or another body makes. And so in order to really kind of see how the law is being applied, is being interpreted, or how other individuals are asserting their rights, and how the government is potentially responding to that, you need access to more than just the court proceedings themselves. You need access to court records.
Got it. We have all of this access, and we have it for the very good reasons you just explained there. You can walk into a courthouse, ask for these records, documents, get a better understanding of how the court works, and pursue accountability, transparency through those means. All right. So now we have this online system that provides us access to court records, making it easier for people to get this information without having to go into the courthouse itself. So are these two ways to get information equal? Are we able to access the same information online as we can inside the courthouse? And if not, what are we missing?
Sure. So the short answer is that they're not equal. And Vermont, like many other states, has struggled at times to navigate the tension between transparency and privacy. You know, Vermonters love their privacy. They value their confidentiality. I mean, we have provisions of our state constitution which offer more robust privacy rights than the federal constitution does. I don't say that because they're a barrier to accessing court records, but more just to reflect that privacy is considered paramount here in this state. And so there are real concerns for a lot of folks about potentially exposing personal or confidential matters or information. So I think the state has struggled with striking the balance between privacy and transparency. And in my opinion, when it comes to remote access to court records, that is ways we can access court records, not physically, but online, the state has erred too far on the side of limiting access. The truth is that even for records for which you have a First Amendment or common law or even statutory right of access in Vermont, where you can go into a courthouse and physically retrieve them, you cannot get all of those records online. And so there is a statute, 12 VSA 5, that provides that even for types of records, like criminal records, where you can access them in full, you have a right of access to them, they shall not be made electronically available. And so there really is a sharp distinction here in Vermont. If you want a civil record, no matter the kind of claim, no matter the privacy interests, you can get that online. If you want a criminal record, however, even if it's about an individual where, you know, they're a public figure, the interest in public access and transparency is at its apex, you still are not able to get those records online. You have to physically go to a courthouse. And so one of the things that we have been hoping to improve upon is Vermont's remote access to court records and ensuring that all Vermonters, no matter where they are, no matter what accessibility barriers they face, are able to access the full range of court proceedings that they have a constitutional and statutory right to.
So we at NEFAC, we've been very vocal about this, advocating for the idea that any record that is public in person at the courthouse should also be public and accessible online as well. But like you mentioned, among other things, there are a number of roadblocks, including this particular statute that prevents the courts from putting criminal records, records that you can easily get if you just go inside the courthouse and ask for them, but it prevents those records from being put online. So, Harry, if you can just go in the courthouse and ask for these records and get them, why do we need them online as well?
I think there are two reasons to be really concerned or interested about this, Justin. One on principle and one more practical. On principle, there is really no reason why we shouldn't make information about the government to which individuals already indisputably have a right to know. There's no good reason for not making that as accessible as it possibly can be. It's critically important to know what the government is up to and the way that the courts are operating. And there's just really no good principled reason based on the way that our democracy is supposed to work to limit that access if individuals already have a right to it. The practical reason is that it is challenging to go to a courthouse in person and request the records. And there are really two components of this, I think. One is that, you know, you can go to a courthouse and you can ask the clerk for particular records, but we already know that our court systems, Justin, are overloaded. There's already delays in a number of cases, and clerks are overworked. And we shouldn't have to go to an administrative professional, ask them to take on yet another task in order for us to view records that are already available. There are also these public terminals, which are supposed to allow individuals to access these records in the courthouse physically, but on a screen. And the truth is, just like a lot of other technology, these terminals are not foolproof. Oftentimes they may not work. There may be connectivity issues. You may not be able to access exactly what you need. And relying on folks to come in person, it's a considerable burden and cost. And that's saying nothing of the many Vermonters who, you know, for reasons of geography, for reasons of disability, for reasons of their other employment or caregiving commitments, simply cannot go physically to a courthouse to access records. And again, I think it's important to emphasize that these are the records that we're talking about are records that everyone agrees under the rules, under the Constitution, under the statute, the public indisputably has a right to. There's no argument that criminal records in general, for example, should not be made publicly available. And so if that's true, there is really no justifiable reason for the system not to at least strive to make this fully accessible and as easily available as the technology will allow.
It seems like what we're discussing here is a matter of equity, making sure that everyone has the same access to government, is able to engage, in this case, with the court system in the same ways, both in person and online. As I mentioned, NEFAC, along with you and your colleagues at the ACLU and a number of other organizations, we've been working with the Vermont Judiciary, making suggestions, advocating for changes that would help this situation and really bring online access on par with the access that we get in person at courthouses. And we'll continue to do so. Harry, thanks so much for taking your time to walk us through these issues and explain to us how the court system works and where it could work better.
Thanks so much for having me, Justin.
Thanks again for listening to the NEFAC Report. Join us next time when we speak with Granite State News Collaborative Director and NEFAC Advisor Melanie Plenda. Melanie will tell us about CivDoc, a program she launched with NEFAC and the Nackies S. Loeb School of Communications to help New Hampshire newsrooms. Here's a preview.
So we offer a very small stipend to have community members cover the meetings. I've had people reach out and say, you don't have to pay me the stipend, I just want to do this. They just want to be able to get that information out to community members.
We'll also hear from NEFAC advisor and reporter Todd Wallet. Todd will discuss search warrant records and how they help local reporting and why they can often be difficult to find in Massachusetts courthouses.
It makes it really difficult without these documents to know how the police are operating, how the criminal justice system is functioning. One of the few windows into how a police operate is court records.
This program is produced by the New England First Amendment Coalition in partnership with Roger Williams University's Communities of Hope under the guidance of Professor Bernardo Mazza. I want to give a huge shout out to our student team. David Peters and Matthew Downey for the editing, Anna Pellegrini for the program logos, Will Feingold for music, Sarah Price for the show notes, Brianna Frisora for promotion, and Lex Benson Amaranti for production assistance. We'll see you next time.